Okay. Hi, I'm Paige Smith, and I am at faculty of at Public Health Education at UNC Greensboro, and I'm director of the Center for Women's Health and Wellness. And we started the Breastfeeding and Feminism Symposium some number of years ago. We're in the planning stages for our fourth one now. And we do this in partnership with the Carolina Breastfeeding Institute at UNC Chapel Hill. And both Miriam LeBach, who is here, and Mary Rose Tolley are part of our planning team and have been involved with the symposium. And Emily Taylor, also from the Carolina Breastfeeding Institute, is here. So we can all answer questions about that if you have any after the fact. We are going to hold all our questions until the end of the talks. The symposium is a national effort to reposition breastfeeding as a fundamental part of women's health and rights. A core belief of the symposium is that in order to increase breastfeeding duration, we need to increase the economic, social, and political status of women, mothers, and caregivers. And the symposium seeks to do this by being a forum that brings together those who are concerned with breastfeeding, with women's reproductive rights, women's economic, social, and political rights, and with public health to form coalitions and collaborative actions. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the background and philosophy of the symposium, an agenda for collaborative action that emerged from our 2007 symposium, and future directions, which is largely the 2009 symposium. And I'd like to start this by talking really briefly about this idea that may be familiar to many people, which is the separation of the public and the private world into different spheres. We have the public world of work and production, which is often becomes associated with masculinity, the private world of reproduction and domesticity, which often becomes associated with femininity. And within each of these worlds, there are different rules and values about what is considered to be good work. And in 2000, attorney Joan Williams published a very important book in the area of work-family balance called Unbending Gender: Why Family and Work Conflict and What to Do About It. And she talks about an idea familiar to most of us here, which is this separation. And she argues that this separation remains an unquestioned American norm and practice, and that this separation has two defining characteristics. One is the organization of market work around the ideal of worker who works full-time, overtime, can move as need be, takes little time off for childbearing and child-rearing. And when work is structured this way, caregivers have a very difficult time performing as ideal workers. And then there's a second characteristic, which is that the system for providing care, caregiving, marginalizes the caregivers and cuts them off from many social roles, as well as economic and political power. And it isn't just that these are dichotomous, but that with most dichotomies, one of these is valued more than the other in our society. And in our world, in our culture, public world really becomes associated with masculinity and the public world, the private world, with femininity. Now, each of these spheres is accompanied by a set of expectations about what it means to do good work in that sphere. And this categorization comes from Fletcher, who is a professor of management. And she talks about the logic of effectiveness, or the body of knowledge that underlies each sphere. And she writes that the distinctions for good work between the two are separate, so that the rules that govern what is appropriate in one sphere are often deemed inappropriate for what is good work in the other sphere. And as with all dichotomies, the construction serves to maintain and continually recreate this separation. The result is that there are two distinct types of knowledge, one about how to produce things and a second about how to grow people. And they rarely inform each other in meaningful ways. So for my example, good work in the productive sphere is paid. It typically has defined hours, maybe 9 to 5 or 9 to 12. It produces goods or services which can be sold. There's a complex skill which can be learned at school or with on-the-job training. And this would apply regardless of whether men or women do this work. Good work in the productive sphere is unpaid. It is done for love. It involves our emotions, It has no set number of hours, which really means it's 24/7. And whatever knowledge we need to perform it is not necessarily learned in school, but is innate or natural or learned from watching others do it. So breastfeeding, of course, mostly resembles good work in the private sphere. It is done for love, not money. It is unpaid, and it has an ambiguous time frame, and it's also 24/7. And it may also lead to the unfortunate but relatively widespread belief that it's innate and that we just learn how to do it on our own. So this dichotomous system marginalizes women and caregivers. And so the feminist movement was very interested in ending women's marginalization and increasing their economic power and political power. And in order to do this, they wanted to increase opportunities for women in the public domain. They wanted more women to be able to go to work and advance in the workplace. But part of the strategy for doing this was the need to challenge full-time mothering as the ideological norm for women and to challenge the biological basis of mothering. They needed to increase the role for men in the private domain, men's responsibility for raising children. They talked about mothering as a verb, which is something then that anybody can do, that men can do. And that child raising, nurturing, and infant feeding were not just something that women had to do or only women could do. And they wanted to separate women's biology from their destiny by advocating for women's reproductive rights, and in particular, contraception and abortion, and with some emphasis on demedicalizing childbirth. Breastfeeding was not discussed very much as part of this movement. In general, it was considered to be an optional behavior, and perhaps a behavior that was not necessarily consistent with the other goals of separating women's biology from mothering and also trying to get more women into the workplace. And it was not part of the reproductive rights agenda. But the strategy that the feminist women and advocates pursued did result in many new opportunities for women. And the key factor, of course, was the increasing employment of women. There were some notable changes. An increase in proportion of women are now in the workplace. An increase in proportion of the workforce is female. And the wages of women workers absolutely, in relative to men, have increased. We still don't have parity in that area, but it has increased over time. So, for example, in 1975, the labor force participation of all mothers was 54%, and by 2001, this had risen to 73%. Mothers with children under six, employment increased by 66% and is now at about 65 or 66%. The labor force participation for mothers with infants under one increases even more dramatically. It went from 31 to 55% by 2000, and that's a 78% increase. Over the same time, although the number of hours worked per week remained about the same, around 35, the number of weeks worked per year has also increased from 40 to 47. So altogether, these trends mean that the annual hours of employment for mothers has doubled when averaged across all mothers. So all of these new opportunities have opened up new resources and experiences for women, but it's also created many dilemmas for women. How many of you are in that increasing dilemma category? So each of us has to make decisions about how to allocate our time over the course of our lifetime, how to allocate our resources, how to allocate our money, our possessions, our energies, and our bodies. Now, this has always been the case. I was just at the San Diego Zoo yesterday watching the mountain gorillas, my favorite. And Sarah Blaffer-Hardy has actually a feminist sociobiologist and does research with animals and mammals. And so she finds that this dilemma is true for them as well as for us. But so these dilemmas change and are different in different places and different cultures and between human and non-human mammals. But she writes that although we are living different lives than our ancestors, both human and non-human, we are still required to resolve the same dilemmas or trade-offs that they had to make. The trade-offs we have to make between living, working, resting, reproducing, and caring for young have always been there. And to some extent, all of these are necessary, but they're increasingly incompatible with each other. The conflict today is not between maternity and women's ambition. Indeed, women have always been ambitious. but between the needs of infants and children and the way a women's ambition plays out in the modern workplace. Now, one of the ideas underlying the Breastfeeding and Feminism Symposium is that this conflict is not really good for breastfeeding duration. So we have a lot of social changes in women's lives, and we could perhaps conclude that it has been these expanding roles, opportunities, and resources that has led to a decrease in breastfeeding, or to not to have the time of breastfeeding duration that we're interested in, particularly among working mothers. But our hypothesis really is that it has been this dramatic increase in women's roles in combination with continued gender inequities in labor, power, and social norms that leads employed mothers to quit breastfeeding, and other mothers as well, before their infants are 6 months old or a year old. So we believe that improving the status of women, especially of mothers and of caregiving, is what we need to improve breastfeeding duration. So let me just talk a little briefly about some of the constraints that we believe are still out there in terms of this issue. The public world constrains breastfeeding in a number of different ways. Clearly, women who pump or breastfeed at work are violating the separation of public and private. They are taking into the workplace something that is typically thought of as being reserved for the home life. Many women I talk to who do work have done a number of interviews, so even if they have some support at work, often feel uncomfortable for if people know that they're pumping. So they may not want to put the milk in the refrigerator and various sorts of things because there's this underlying tension about violating the public-private separation. Another reason that breastfeeding practice is so difficult is that women, in order to breastfeed, need to have control. They need to have control over their time and over their bodies and over their space, and they need flexibility, or they need proximity to their baby. And unfortunately, this need bumps up against the rigidity, the continued rigidity, and the gender nature of the workplace that organizes work around this ideal worker who works as needed and doesn't really try to combine it with family life. So this makes it breastfeeding practice much more difficult, but it also marginalizes women who engage in maternal practices. Joan Williams writes that the structure of work links the ability to be an ideal worker to the privileges available only to men, allowing women to the choice to perform as ideal workers without the privileges is not equality. Women may choose not to perform as an ideal worker, but they do not choose the marginalization that accompanies this decision. So we've gotten women into the workplace, but we haven't changed the workplace, and we still often say that women need to learn to play by men's rules, rather than saying we need to change the rules. Employment is not the only constraint on breastfeeding in the public sphere. It requires women to use their breasts for maternal purposes rather than for sexual ones, and if women are to be mobile and not confined to the house, they need to be able to breastfeed in novel places that are outside the house, whether it's my favorite coffee shops or airports or parks or stores or other places. And women who breastfeed in public often do so against the perception by many that it is obscene and exhibitionist. And we do have laws that allow women to breastfeed any place women are allowed to be, but the problem is that most space in this country is private space, so that if women are asked to leave private space, they no longer have a right to be there. The way work is managed in the private domain also constrains breastfeeding. So both liberal and radical feminists agree that in order for women to achieve equality at the workplace, men needed to pick up some of the child care. And this really did not happen very much. The feminists, since breastfeeding is also a maternal practice that women can't relegate to somebody else, they actually have to do it. So it challenges this notion of mothering as a verb that anybody can do. Bernice Hausman writes that it forces us to think about women as mothers and mothers as women. So altogether, these continued inequities result in motherhood being the biggest barrier for economic equality for women today, a leading cause of poor health for women, and the single greatest risk for poverty in old age. And breastfeeding is, of course, has a short duration, and there are disparities by race, income, and opportunity with younger, less educated, lower income, unmarried, minority women breastfeeding less. So this really is the background of the Breastfeeding and Feminism Symposium, and our goal is to reposition breastfeeding as a valued part of women's reproductive rights and lives, raise the profile of breastfeeding within women's advocacy and feminist communities, and increase recognition among breastfeeding supporters that breastfeeding promotion could receive more socio-political support by partnering with those who are concerned with women's reproductive health rights and justice, women's economic advancement, and the elimination of gender, social, economic, and health inequities. So it started in 2005, and we are now planning for the one for 2009. In 2007, we partnered with people who were very interested in reproductive health, rights, and justice, and we created working groups to find areas of synergy and common ground. And a lot of synergy was created around the idea that we recognize economic, political, and cultural connections between women's rights to have children and their rights not to have children. We support women in their goal of being able to mother in ways that are consistent with their own values and still be creatively and productively employed in the labor force. And we recognize that the decision to breastfeed is not yet a realistic choice for many women, and we need policies and programs that provide all women with control over their bodies and their lives, including work. We have a lot of recommendations, and most of these recommendations you can find. We published a thematic issue on breastfeeding and feminism in the International Breastfeeding Journal. So if you Google breastfeeding and feminism, you may just find this. Or you can go to the International Breastfeeding Journal and look up that thematic issue. And we had areas of synergy around the different aspects of the social ecological model, and all of these you can find in the presentations. And if you go to my website or Miriam's website, you can get a link to the full proceedings from the 2007 symposium. And the next one is From the Birthplace to the Workplace, and I hope that all of you will come and tell your friends. March 26th and 27th at UNCG. Thank you. So our next speaker is Miriam Abak, and many of you who are in breastfeeding know Miriam very well. She is currently the professor and director of the Carolina Breastfeeding Institute at UNC Chapel Hill, and prior to that, she has worked in the academia at Johns Hopkins. She was the head of maternal health at USAID and a senior advisor in the Infant Young Child Feeding and Care program at UNICEF. Miriam.